Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
There are several things that I hadn't thought of before until Nancy asked me two or three questions. And one threw me completely, which was about how my parents treated me and what impact that may have had on the way I brought up my kids. And that is something I hadn't really thought of. So there was some thought here that I was not anticipating, but I'm glad it happened.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Today's guest mentor is multi-venture entrepreneur Skip Thaller. He loves the challenge of starting and growing successful new businesses. He is hardworking, generous, and competitive. And if you were listening to our first conversation, you noticed that he has a real knack for taking a look and analyzing through critical thinking what he's doing in the world and how the venture's going after a certain period of time. He's good at prospecting and capitalizing on opportunities that surface in the marketplace to create new businesses, and it's been part of his lifeblood to success. And it's also the focus of a sequence of three conversations that we're talking with him about. When I was teaching entrepreneurship at St. Kate's and St. Mary's University, one of the opportunities, I think, in one of the characteristics of our entrepreneurs is their ability to see a window of opportunity and knowing the timing of when to capitalize on it and when to expand it, or what some people say, exploit the opportunity and make it into something that can support yourself and your family and in some cases really support a lot of other people. And so what we're doing in this conversation is in story form, real life story, breaking down Skip Thaller's experiences as a multi-venture entrepreneur so that you can kind of get an idea of what the window of opportunities were that showed up in his life and how he capitalized on it very successfully. I haven't talked to many entrepreneurs who have had such a successful financial life as an entrepreneur in every single venture he's gotten into. And so I really want you to kind of tune into that for yourself as an entrepreneur to hone that skill in a way that fits for you in the industry that you're in. So, welcome back to the program, Skip Thaller.
Thanks, Nancy. Appreciate the opportunity.
How are you feeling?
I'm incredible. Thanks. Getting better, though.
Okay, as we go along. Yeah, so today's sponsor is Sally Doyle, who wants you to take action before the year's end. Great Lakes Bookkeeping not only provides relief from the tedious bookkeeping tasks, but also uses the information as a roadmap to advise owners of opportunities that can help their business. With over 20 years of experience and expertise, owners trust Sally to help them achieve their goals and dreams. Right now, you can reach her to get a profit analysis, cash flow projection, and end-of-year advice. So call Sally to get it done. The end of the year is right around the corner. Thank God. We can say goodbye to 2020.
Amen.
Yeah. Great Lakes Bookkeeping. Give Sally a call at 1-651-208-8151. You can also reach her at greatlakesbookkeeping.com. So, Skip, you were raised in Chippewa Falls in Wisconsin as the eldest of four children. So your father role modeled kind of the entrepreneurial lifestyle. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, and at the time I never knew it, but it's funny how osmosis at the dinner table, you know, because all the conversations were when he'd come back from whatever he was doing, because he did everything from fireworks stands to showing free movies to small towns that didn't have movie theaters back in the 50s to he finally got into the oil business, which was where he grew you know, got really his, I guess, would you say his franchise, so to speak, was the most successful business was the oil business.
And what was your mom up to while he was doing this? Did she join him in the ventures?
Watching out for four kids.
Okay. So, yeah, that's definitely a full-time job.
Yes.
So, Skip, you married your childhood sweetheart, Jill, and you've described yourself as being blessed in raising three adult children, George, Sarah, and Tim, and that you now have seven grandchildren.
Right.
So there's entrepreneurship classes now, but I noticed in the classes that I taught for 14 years, there's emerging entrepreneurs, and a lot of the students in the class were already in entrepreneurial ventures, but some would never see themselves as starting their own venture. Do you see a difference between those who are more entrepreneurial, who can see the entrepreneur's vision and venture, but not want to, and take risks with them, but not want to put their own finances at stake?
I think it all depends on the situation. You know, when you say finances at stake, it depends on what the potential gain is versus the potential loss. And I would say that there's many, you know, there's people that will work for entrepreneurs that are entrepreneurial themselves. I had a lot of them in my business.
Okay. And how did you spot them?
I ran ads. One of my first salesmen was a person that was selling TVs at Dayton Hudson. I told Jill, my wife, that if I could ever hire anybody, or if I needed to ever hire anybody, I would come back to him. I got his calling card, and about 6 months later, I needed a salesman. I called him, and actually turned out to be one of my better salesmen. And I would interview people three times, okay, to make sure. And I'd be usually a week apart, and I'd ask the same questions in different ways, make sure that they were always answering them the way the first time was asked, but in a different way. And I had an industrial psychologist. Spent a half a day with them, and that was the real test. And every time I hired anybody he told me not to, I regretted it. So he was right.
Okay. Yeah, because I can imagine that you could get kind of interested in someone who might not have been a right fit.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't know their past, and he finds their past out very quickly.
Oh, excellent. Your first job out of school was in sales with IBM, and you left there to start a manufacturing representative business selling Fleetwood tires. And that led to the most successful Fleetwood franchise in the United States. You created a brokerage tire business to sell discontinued and blemished tires that grew into a $13 million in sales per year business. This financial success then positioned you to do a merge with Tires Plus. Do you want to describe a little bit? You started talking at the end of our conversation about how Tom Gigex and Don Gillette, who started Tires Plus, it was a different name at the time, but you were finding yourself kind of competing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
Well, then we took about 6 months to study how we could put the two businesses together. I ended up running the retail or wholesale, and Tom ended up running the retail. At that time, wholesale was about 2/3 of our volume, the total, you know, to combine two businesses, and retail was about 1/3 of it.
Okay. And what made the partnership work initially? When you were looking at, like, how can we merge these businesses, were you also looking at how will we partner successfully together? And was developing lanes?
That's the difficult part, is who's going to do what, who's, you know, because there can only be one chief, so much, so to speak. I think we did that quite well, all things considered. I ended up being the chairman and Tom was the president. So he took care of the day-to-day. I ran the wholesale. He ran the retail. We were big enough that we stayed out of each other's hair at the time. But as time went on, retail and wholesale competed with each other. I'll give you an example. Let's say I had a wholesale account in St. Paul on University Avenue, and Tires Plus wanted to put a retail store across the street from them. Well, the wholesale account didn't want to buy from his competition, and that started to create, you know, some issues. So that, you know, was, we were able to work it out, but it did start to strain things.
Yeah, I can see why, because at the time they had 40 stores.
Well, when we, now actually at the time when we merged, we had 11 stores.
Okay.
And we grew it to 40 stores by the time I left.
Oh, I see. Went from 11 to 40. Wow. And how did you learn to manage all the finances with that? Like, where did you get your understanding in of how to just do all the financial work involved in all that?
It's interesting you ask me that, because I think back in college, you know, taking accounting courses and all of that, you know, you remember debits and credits, and you do things that you memorize for the test. But I never did understand the big picture between like balance sheets and income statements. And then fast forward to my first job at IBM, I'm calling on businesses that I'm going to help them with their you know, putting their financial information on the computer. I learned in a hurry. Okay. And I probably learned, you know, and then the next thing was, is in selling to, say, members in the Fleetwood program, dealers, I would have to look at their financial statement to see if they were qualified to be able to even get a line of credit. So you take the theory from school and you marry it with the practical application from IBM and Fleetwood, and the next thing you know, you then you know how to read balance sheets and income statements.
Yeah, that makes sense. And while you're talking about school, I think what I was going to say too is entrepreneurs don't always feel like they're successful at school. And you went on to get not only an undergraduate degree but also a master's degree in international business. So how did you feel about education in general at that time?
Well, I made the statement, and because I got into, and we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here, but later on I got into international business, and that was like 30 years later, 25 years later.
Right. So that...
I always said at the time, I said with 50 cents and an MBA in international business, I could start a business. And you know, the education was fine. I became familiar with what it was about. But, you know, being able to take the principles that I learned back then and translate them into creating a business was, I don't think, very practical. Okay. I learned more from being in business than I did studying about business.
Yeah. And it sounds like you did take some of the theories that you learned from school, and you kind of adjusted it to real life.
Yeah, I think to some degree, right.
Yeah. Would you have made the same decision about getting a BA in business and economics and a master's in international business?
You mean from hindsight?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the only difference would be is I would have gone out and worked in the real world before I went right on to graduate school, so that maybe you could apply some of those things to it. And you got to remember also back, I got my MBA in 1968. There weren't many companies doing international business. Firestone was one of them. Just coincidentally, they happened to be in the tire business, but you could count on one hand the number of people that were, you know, doing international business. We weren't even trading with Russia. I mean, Russia had the Iron Curtain up then. So it was completely different game back then.
Huh. Interesting. So while you were with Tires Plus, what began to kind of terrify you?
Oh, good question. It was interesting because when we put the deal together, we had divided the stock up, and based on the percentage of stock, you then we were going to have that as our guarantee. In other words, what we would call a limited guarantee. Okay, so we would, let's say that you had $1 million exposure or $100,000 exposure. That's how much you were going to be limited to. We found out later, after we put the deal together, that you can't limit guarantees. Okay, so now all of a sudden, my whole my net worth is on the line, whether we make it or not. And so what they do is, a bank will go to the person with, say, the deepest pockets. And at that time, I was fortunate enough to have it. They had all their money in the business. I had a lot outside of it. And as a result, I had a lot more exposure. And I laid awake many nights thinking about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was one of the things that brought me to that point. So of making the decision to have them buy me out.
Because you had personally guaranteed any money that was taken out to...
Yeah, and we had a four-man executive committee. I being one of the four, Don and Tom being the two, and then we had a CFO by the name of Scott Wiederquist. Scott was a very small owner in the business, but Don and I and Tom controlled the business. And we would make decisions based on one vote for one person. And I usually was the odd man out. I was the conservative one because, like I say, I had a lot to lose and I was just not comfortable with the rate of expansion that we were going at. And that really led to me saying, I'm not going to slow this train down. I'll just get out. And that's when I made that decision.
Hmm. How regular were your meetings? Did you have regular meetings?
We had weekly meetings.
Okay.
Matter of fact, that was one of my criticisms of being in a larger organization was all I did is spend my time in meetings. And I was part of the problem, okay? In other words, I was creating these meetings so that you can communicate, you know, because you've got different departments, you got shipping, you got accounting, you got marketing, you got, you know, the bigger it gets, the more segmented you become. And as a result, then you have to have everybody talking to one another. But what I like, I mean, I saw a loss in my productivity there.
Yeah.
Because that's not my personality. Okay. Now, Tom was very good at it and he excelled at it. He, you know, it was an excellent fit for him.
Yeah. And what made sense then for him to kind of build it out differently than you might have.
Right. Yep.
So you learned three main things that you took into your next opportunity. What? Eliminate inventory, restrict the need for lots of people, and no accounts receivable.
Go ahead, Tom. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Was there anything else?
Well, what I learned was, I remember the first day we had rented the old Toro warehouse just off of 35W in Burnsville. It's a 150,000 square foot warehouse. I never had inventory before. And all of a sudden I wake up and I'm sitting in this building with 30 doors that are taking tires in and out because they inventoried things. I sold everything from somebody else's inventory. And I thought to myself, my God, what did I get myself into? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And anyway, but I, you know, as time went on, I got more and more comfortable. But one of the commitments I made to myself was not to, when I got out of that business, was not to ever be in a situation where I had inventory that I was responsible for. Okay. And, you know, you ask what I learned from that is, that was one thing. I'll work off somebody else's inventory. Let them worry about the, you know, the turn on the inventory. And the other thing I learned from that was, as part of that was, is because I had, when I got out of that part of the business, maybe. Well, I tell you what, I'll wait, and we can talk about that in the third segment. But basically, was. I negotiated terms with them, and what I would do is prepay those terms and get significant discounts that added to the profitability. But the second thing was the need for employees, you know, in a business. Obviously, when you're running a retail operation on a large wholesale, you need lots of people, you need support staff, you need equipment, etc. But I found a way that I did not need to do that. I did not need employees to leverage myself, because I could hire other people to do that. And the last thing was the receivable risk. I used banks in creating what they call site drafts to take care of that part of the business. And so here I am, I'm one person, and I have no accounts receivable, or I have accounts receivable, but I have no risk associated with them because the banks are doing my collections. I have no employees because I have freight forwarders moving my freight. They're a third-party company. I have insurance to take care of potential losses. And then I'm using other people's inventory. So I'm a one-man band that has all these other resources available to him, but doesn't have to pay for them on a weekly basis, so to speak. You only pay for them when you use them.
And that's how you formed Intercontinental Marketing Corporation,
IMC. Right.
You became an international tire broker. And this is what you were alluding to earlier in our conversation about 30 years later.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. You're taking your international education and you're applying it and updating it because our world changed a lot in 30 years.
Yes. Exactly.
So you ship tires where there was a surplus of tires or defective tires from one country to another.
Not defective. We would call them blemished. They would be cosmetic. In other words, the integrity of the tire was good. It just, maybe the white wall got marked or something. And so it was a cosmetic problem.
It's kind of like these stores that have a gently used items.
They weren't used. They were.
These are new but blemished. Okay.
New but blemished. They just have a blem on them, or discontinued. Say, such as the manufacturer built too many of a particular size for, say, Kmart or Sears or Uniroyal, whatever, they needed a way to get rid of them. So what they would do is, in the case of Kmart, they would take the K off. And we would call them Mart tires, okay? They would just take a buffer and buff the letter K off each tire so they didn't have to follow on the warranty, and we could sell those tires at a significant discount. And then with, like, Uniroyal, they took the U and the Y, Uniroyal, the last three letters, and they were called Niro tires, okay?
Oh.
And basically, they were perfectly good tires. They just... they were excess or surplus, and we'd buy them at a discount. And
how would you get notified that there's an excess of these blemished tires?
Okay, so a couple ways. I had relationships with different people. For example, Big O Tires, which now I think they're in the Twin Cities, and that's completely a different company as it was back then. They were a company out west. And their tires were manufactured by Uniroyal, and anything that was a blemish, they would take into their warehouse out in Colorado. And the Big O was responsible for paying for those tires and, you know, selling them. They did not want to sell them through their normal distribution. So what they did is in their normal distribution was like in six or seven states out west at the time. They would call, developed a relationship with the person that was in charge, and he would call me, and I would ship them in the states that they didn't have stores in. So I didn't interfere with their marketing, and that was one way. Another way would be I would buy, you know, like I was mentioning before, the Sears or the Kmart tires. Manufacturers had people they would go to. I was one of them. And they just wanted the tires to go away. They didn't want a lot of fanfare to be with it, and didn't want us to disturb the market. So the other thing was I could pay cash for a lot of things that I did, and manufacturers always like that.
Okay. And you were operating when you started IMC with a 5-year non-compete.
Correct.
With Tires Plus. So is that how the international aspect of it became viable for you?
I'm not sure. I have to think about that. Basically, when I started looking, I to do something different, I wanted to stay in the field I was in. And, you know, the international was always in the back of my mind, hence my degree. And I guess I met some people there were not many people doing what I ended up doing, probably 3 or 4 in the United States. But I got to know one person very well, and he became kind of a mentor for me. So I said, you know, when I jumped on an airplane, I went to a trade show in Europe and met a lot of people and came back. And, you know, I made the decision that that's what I wanted to do.
Ah, okay.
So it's funny, Nancy, because when I came back, I had all these calling cards from all these different countries over there. Remember, the European Union wasn't in existence. Italy was Italy. Germany was Germany. We had lire. We had Deutschmarks. We had francs. Okay. We have pounds, which we still do. And all these countries are operating autonomously from one another. There's borders and so on. They all have their own rules. They all have their own currency. But the most difficult thing for me was when I got back, I had all these cards. And on the cards, I had the person's name, but they never had the country on the card. So when I went to call them, and they never put the country code on because they knew each other. Okay, so they didn't put country codes on the cards. Yeah. So I had to figure out how to get the country codes and figure out which country these people were in. That was the biggest problem I had in starting to develop the business.
Sure. And how did you start forming some trusting relationships? Because overseas, in order for this to work, shipping, you know, tires from one country to another, you don't have the inventory yourself. There's a lot you can't control.
That's true. But as I mentioned previously about the bank being my accounts, you know, in other words, the method of payment that I used was what they call a site draft. And what that is when you load a product, when say I would go to say a Tires Plus, the name of the company was called Condura. That was the name of the company that owned Tires Plus. I'd go to the Condura warehouse. That was the warehouse or the wholesale portion of it. And load the tires. I'd get a packing list, create an invoice, and send the invoice along with a draft that was created on, say, in this case, I think it was Wells Fargo. And that then became the legal title to the goods. And I'd send a copy to the bank that was the bank of the customer that was receiving the tires. Yeah. I'd send one to my bank. And I'd send one to the freight forwarder. Those were 3 pieces of paper that were the title. Anybody that owned that paper could pick those tires up, and they had title. So what happened was that when there was an understanding between banks that those papers never changed hands until the draft was paid, okay? So what happened was the bank in Germany, Bundesbank, okay, had a site draft. My customer would go down there and he would pay for that site draft, pick up that piece of paper, and then go pick up the goods.
Oh, I see.
So that allowed me not to have receivables and not to have the risk of not being paid. So to answer your question, that was one way. The other way was just going to trade shows. I went to Dubai. I went to Essen, Germany. I went to London, England. I went to Singapore, and I met a lot of different people there. And it's kind of like a society of people that, you know, that's their business. You get, you get to know people. People have reputations, and I could make a couple calls to find out about somebody. And, you know, it wasn't 100%, but it was probably 98% accurate. So,
wow. You also needed to a new vocabulary and understanding of the ratio of currencies with each country and which companies had no markers and E-mark or department transportation stickers. So how long did it take you to acclimate to doing business and also generating real revenue overseas?
Well, generating revenue was not a problem. I put $5,000 in that business, in the brokerage business, and I never put another nickel in it. So I was, because I didn't have any expenses, okay? I was immediately profitable. Anything I sold, I kept for the most part, you know, other than small costs. But what, you know, to get back to your first question, I went to the World Trade Center, which does not exist anymore, which was it was incredibly helpful. They had seminars for people that wanted to start businesses. I don't know what happened to it, but at that time, it was just invaluable. So I went to those seminars, went to the library, I did a lot of reading. I met people at trade shows, and I knew a lot of people in the business, or I knew a couple of people, I should say, in the business in the USA. And as a result of that, I just, parlayed one thing to another, developed in a way of invoicing and creating offers and proformas and all the technical terms that are used in that industry. It didn't take long because I had, you know, I had the business experience with it. So.
Oh, sure. Now, you got into the business, there's a learning curve, but you were able to figure out the money part and how to get access to these tires and get them from point A to point B. How did you continue to shape IMC?
First we started out in new passenger tires, and then I tried some different products. I tried some sporting good products. I went down to Irwin Jacobs' place at the time. He was in the same type of business, different products. Looked at maybe, you know, trying to do something similar to that. And I found out one thing, do one thing, do it well. So I looked at passenger tires. I said, well, we're doing a good job here. Why don't we get into motorcycle tires or agricultural tires or truck tires or casings? Basically it's the same verbiage. And sometimes, many times, the same customer or supplier. And you just keep yourself very efficient, especially when you're a one- or two-man operation.
Wow. And your son now, one of your sons, George, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Who joined
mm-hmm.
you in the business. So tell us a little bit about how that evolved.
Well, he worked with me for probably 15 years. And, We had a lot of good times. We had some rough times, but the end result was he became very successful on his own right in the business. And I woke up one morning about 8-9 years ago and said, I just don't need to do this anymore. I don't need the financial aspect of it. I don't need the pressure and the stress. And he needs to be doing his own thing. And as a result, I turned it over to them, and they ended up paying the taxes. I sold it to them at a very nominal amount and ended up paying the tap, basically equivalent to the taxes, and the rest is history.
Okay. Really? And you kept your hands off it?
I did.
Wow.
I did.
How did you manage that? I mean...
Well, you know, the thing is that's not my personality. Okay. Cause I know everything, you know, in terms of what I was doing.
Right.
I don't mean that. I mean that in tongue in cheek. Okay. But it's a father son relationship. And,
a point to emotionally detach? Because that is the hardest thing between family member generations, you know, handing a business off to a father, son, or father, daughter, or, you know, mother, daughter, or mother, son. Either way, that transition is usually very rocky, and it's emotionally very difficult to detach from something that you birthed.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you do that?
I just did it. I mean, it
did it
was,
evolve
if you would have viewed it from afar, You would say it never would work. But what I realized was that George had been successful in his own right. He had his own book of business, okay? So all I was doing is turning the business over to him and Tim, our other son, the youngest one. And I just woke up one morning and said, this is it. I'm going to do it. And I never looked back. And the other thing I learned from that, Nancy, was I was available as a consultant. I mean, I worked with them for about 2 weeks. And then they would call me and ask me questions because they're dealing with my accounts, okay? But it was very limited, and they only got me involved when they absolutely needed to. Okay, so my hat's off to them.
So you set up some good boundaries.
Yeah, we did. And what I learned from this was there's more than one way to run a business. I remember that I always taught them to negotiate hard, get the price down that you're going to pay for the product as low as you can get it, and get the price up that you're going to sell it as high as you can sell it. Well, about 6 months after I got out of the business, we were buying a lot of casings from a particular country. And
what are casings for?
Casings are basically, they're a used tire that is being sold to a retreader for recapping. Okay. In other words, they're a used tire that they put a new tread on it because the tire itself has a couple life cycles to it. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's retreading. Okay.
Okay.
So, but what I learned was that I thought, well, you negotiate that way. Well, George, unbeknownst to me at the time, he said, they were having a real problem with supply of getting the product. And so there was a shortage. So what he did is he went in and asked them, for what price they would sell them at. And he took that price and he added a couple dollars to it, just the opposite of what I would do. I would say take a couple dollars off of it. Well, not thinking of the fact that there's a shortage and only so many people are going to get product, he had the common sense and the business intuition to say, I'll give you more money. And he ended up getting all that product in that country for a couple of years because he was paying more for it. And he would, he would, because he was the only one that had it, he could sell it for whatever he wanted. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, then I realized that, there's more than one way to do things. Okay.
Yeah. Awesome. Great, powerful, learned lessons.
Yes.
So about the time you and I met, you were an avid sailor. You were still running IMC. And Jill was really into orchids.
Jill and Skip were into orchids. Skip was probably more into orchids than Jill.
Okay. Oh, really? You were?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. And you were also, so you had said to me, I think I'm retired, but you also had joined one of our mentoring groups with Judson Bemis Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
I do, yes.
Okay. What do you remember about it?
I'm sorry, what?
What do you remember about being in that group?
I just remember that name. That's all I remember.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And so you were retired, but then I remember you saying to me, not a lot of people are retired at age 50. And so I really like working. And so you were kind of just into sailing at that point, or?
Yeah, I would say I was in my infancy. I had done a lot of small boat sailing, but I was just into larger boat sailing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to finish out there because there's, in our last conversation, you become a landlord, and that's a whole another industry that's worth kind of exploring of how you learned about it. And tell us a little bit about the orchids. Do you still have them? Because they're the hardest.
No, we have the greenhouse, which is about an 800 square foot atrium above a 3-car garage in the woods in Lakeville. Okay.
Okay.
That now is a workout room. when they outlawed pesticides and we had to use organic pesticides, the bugs won. Okay, bugs won. Skip and Joel, nothing. Okay, and we ended up losing about 1,000 orchids as a result of that. We did it more as a hobby than anything, and you know, you asked the question, well, how did I find time for sailing, because I did a lot of it at that time. Sailing came first, only after family, okay? But what I would do is, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and I would do my business, because you got to remember, people I'm doing business with are in completely different time zones, okay? So when we are awake and working here, they are either getting up or going to bed, okay? So I was able to get up at, say, 5 in the morning, get my stuff done at 8. And if it was a nice day, I went sailing. If it wasn't, I would work. And then when I'd get home, if I went sailing at, say, 6 o'clock, I could start to work with the Far East. And so I was still working, but I was doing it on my, you know, on, I could work 24 hours because of the way the customers and the time zones were. Wow. So And I didn't have to be there. You know, it wasn't a business that you had to open up every morning, because it was mostly at that time was fax machines. So, you know, if I got a fax, I'd answer it, you know, when I got home.
Sure. Well, that worked well then with IMC. Excellent.
Yeah, it did.
Oh, good. All right. Well, I love the way this conversation kind of took shape, and you learned a lot and then transitioned your business from yourself to George. And where is Tim at in the Intercontinental Marketing Company?
Tim still has some ownership in it, but he took a different path. He was in charge of an IT department of a $500 million travel agency. That you can imagine what that travel agency looks like today with COVID. Okay. He moved to Seattle. He has incredible talent in the technology area. Sales, you know, he was good at it, but I don't think he really liked it as much. And as a result, he, you know, ended up going where his avocation was, and probably did, you know, that was the right thing.
Sure.
But he still helps George out with the books and so on.
Okay. And what about Sarah? How does she fit in the mix?
Sarah has 4 children. And a husband, okay, to take care of. She's got her hands full. She's in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And bless, you know, she could be very capable of doing any of these things that I've been able to impart on George and Tim. Or she has a special personality and a special gift of intellect that she could do any of this. But she's right now a mother of 4 kids. And you can imagine with COVID, they're all going to 4 different schools.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
So she's got her hands full.
Yeah. Yeah. Not an easy time for any parent of young school
exactly.
age kids. Yeah. Well, very good. All right. Well, thank you so much for these gems of wisdom and describing, you know, all the learned lessons and the opportunities that have surfaced and how you kind of capitalized on those and shaped them and molded them in a direction that was very extremely profitable. So in our next conversation, we're going to talk a little bit more about IMC and then how you transitioned to become a landlord of 25 properties.
Okay.
And you can still laugh
about it. I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to that, Nancy, and thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thank you for tuning in and listening and learning from Skip Thaler. This is a really unique opportunity to be able to do that. So I'm glad that you're taking advantage of it. And thanks, Mike Abea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère, brother from another mother. And we'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become more effective as a business owner? Do you want to reinvent yourself or evolve as you redesign your business? This is a dual innovation process. Are you ready to take charge of who you next become? If the answer is yes,
I've been developing and implementing mentoring programs to thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and business owners and their teams since 1992. I totally love it and feel I'm on this planet to involve the leadership in the world from the inside out. Of course, this means seeing myself as a work in progress, which is beneficial to you because I'm not stagnant and I'm motivated to create and bring you incredible programming all the time. So here's a few ways that you can get involved in our We Mentor self-leadership community. You can subscribe for free through wementor.com to the podcast. You can also find it on Apple Podcasts, which used to be iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Blueberry Directory, iHeartRadio, or TuneIn Radio, which is where you can shout out your request on smart home device through Alexa, Cortana, Amazon Echo, and Google Home. You can also become a sponsor of this program and support what's happening here in these all these meaningful conversations. Or you can get one-on-one mentoring and go at your own pace as you evolve into the leader that you've always wanted to become. You can join a We Mentor Mini Lab, which we offer several times during the year. We're focused on some element of self-leadership and your progress toward becoming more effective. And the last and final way in which you can get involved in We Mentor's self-leadership community is by joining a one-year entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab where we dig into the details and help you with the operational along with your leadership skills so you can evolve with your entity and really, really progress in building the life that you've always wanted to build. So please check out wementor.com. You can email me, nancy@wementor.com, or call me, 1-612-804-8920. All right, keep listening, and we'll see you next week.